华尔街最具影响力的经济学家之一，过往以准确预测1997年亚洲金融风暴和2008年全球金融海啸而闻名的 Morgan Stanley 前亚洲区主席罗奇 Stephen Roach， 他曾经预言中国有望在2030年左右超越美国，成为全球最大的经济体。但他近年来对中国经济的预测转趋悲观，甚至坦言香港已经玩完了。中共建政75周年之际，中国的经济奇迹是否繁华落尽？习近平的中国梦还有可能实现吗？美国之音纵深视角专访现任耶鲁大学高级研究员的罗奇教授，请他从过去20多年来在中港两地的个人经历，以及与历任中共高层领导人的第一手互动，深入剖析当前中国经济危机的症结，并以日本失落的30年为借鉴，提出可能的解决方案。同时探讨当前陷入新冷战的美中关系是否可能出现第二个到中国破冰的尼克松式人物呢？下面请看本期纵深视角和 Stephen Roach 的专访。President Xi Jinping is celebrating PRC's 75th anniversary. First, I'd like you to provide some reality check here on his China dream, which is perceived as a competition to American dream. You predict China would surpass United States by around 2030, but President Biden said that China will not surpass United States anymore, at least on his watch, right? So can China still have the chance to become the world's largest economy, in your opinion?
First of all, just backing up to the Chinese dream, it's been interpreted as a call to competition with the United States, but it's really more about the rejuvenation of the Chinese economy with benefits to the Chinese people, implying that China would return to its once dominant role in the global economy that existed, in the early part of the 19th century. But there was no direct mention made of the United States. As to whether China surpasses the United States at some point, I think it's still entirely conceivable, but China has a number of challenges to face right now and must address those challenges before it returns to a trajectory that puts it back on the course to surpass the United States. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, the Chinese population is 4 times that of the United States. So convergence in absolute dollar terms is very different than would be the case if the convergence were to occur on a per person or per capita basis. That is a very distant proposition at best. But if China addresses its structural problems as well as some of its near-term cyclical issues forcefully, I still see no reason why there couldn't be convergence at some point. Mm-hmm. 2030, maybe a little bit later than I thought initially, but certainly within the 2030s.
But now, in your opinion, what's the real problem with China's economy? Is that the burst of the poverty crisis, the housing bubble, or the aging population, or the FDI or the stock market losing momentum, or everything altogether brewing a perfect storm in China right now?
Look, I am not in the China crisis camp. I think the Chinese economy has slowed. It remains weak. Mm-hmm. The challenges are complex. For the purposes of sort of exposition, I would break them down into short-term or cyclical problems and longer-term structural problems. The short-term problems are dominated by the property crisis, as you indicated, and that's ongoing, and the program that is under place to address the property crisis, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, is not adequate to signal an all clear sign. But I think that'll happen, you know, at some point within the next few years. The longer term issues, though, are very serious, and I would really highlight three of them. One, you alluded to, the demography, the decline in the working age population. This is underway and is going to continue well through the end of the century. Secondly, weak productivity growth. When economies have a declining working age population, they need stronger productivity to offset that. And productivity is going the other way in China right now because so much of the economy has been shifted under Xi Jinping back to low productivity state-owned enterprises. And there's been a lot of pressure on the private sector, which has long been the most dynamic source of productivity. And then the third structural problem is the well-known lack of internal private consumption. This is a topic I've been preaching about in my work on China for now nearly 20 years. And, you know, the government from time to time, as they are right now, seems to be mindful of addressing that problem, but they haven't taken the type of actions that I would conclude would be sufficient to spark a revival in consumption. So I put that all together, and the growth challenges in China, both cyclical and structural, are considerable right now, but they can be overcome by forceful and creative policies.
Professor Roach, we will delve into the consumption-led rebalancing later to discuss why it is so difficult for China to do this economic transformation. But to address your first question, Beijing now finally decided to raise the retirement age. Do you think they are on the right track, the right direction to addressing the challenges?
When you have a declining working age population, as we saw in Japan, have seen in Japan for now nearly 30 years, there's very little you can do. I mean, China, of course, has relaxed the one-child family planning policy, but young women of childbearing age are not necessarily cooperating in family sizes, and birth rates still remain insufficient to provide, you know, an optimistic view on a return to rapid population growth. China's had a ridiculously low retirement age for a long time and recently has enacted provisions to raise the retirement age slightly. And this is a good thing, but the increases are small and, again, will extend the working tenure for both male and female by a few years, but not sufficient, in my view, to really create a powerful resurgence of personal consumption. Bigger reforms need to take place in expanding the benefits paid by the social safety net so that as workers near their retirement age, even if it's been extended by a few years, they have a sense of financial security in looking to the future. Hukou reform is also important because so many workers, nearly 300 million migrant workers now, don't have the security of looking to safety net funding, whether it's retirement or health care, because they've chosen to work in communities where they don't hold a residential hukou certificate. So a lot more needs to be done. I applaud the small step that was taken to lift the retirement age, but it's certainly not enough, in my opinion.
Professor Roach, you had a seminar on Japan in Yale University for many years.
What lessons can China learn from Japan's last 30-year economic stagnation? What strategies in Xi Jinping's toolkit to better address the current economic challenges than Japan, in your opinion?
The Japanese problem was a very serious problem, and I did teach a very popular seminar called the Lessons of Japan at Yale, and we studied Japan for the first half of the seminar, but then we studied the applicability of those lessons to other economies, including the United States, Europe, and especially China. And what we concluded in the class was, number one, avoid asset bubbles, whether there are equity bubbles or technology bubbles, or most relevant for China, property bubbles. Number two, avoid the debt intensity of economic activity, because ultimately that constricts private actors, whether they're businesses or consumers, from providing support to domestic demand because they are so constrained by their burdens to service their excess debt. And third and finally, we concluded it was very important for nations to take actions to boost productivity growth. You know, Japan had an approach that former and now the late Premier Shinzo Abe put in place a number of years ago called Abenomics that had three arrows, monetary, fiscal, and structural, mainly reflecting measures to boost productivity. And that third arrow, the productivity arrow, was the toughest one for him to put in place, and it ultimately could be the toughest one for China as well. I've given, probably now 15 lectures in China about the lessons of Japan and their relevance for China. The most recent lecture I gave was just this past summer in Beijing. And so there's a good deal of understanding and interest in the lessons of Japan. There was a famous interview published on the front pages of People's Daily back in May of 2016, an interview by a so-called authoritative person, a high policy official, rumored to be very close to President Xi Jinping, who warned of the perils of a Japanese-like stagnation for China. And this has been actively debated in senior policy circles in China now for over 8 years. You know, it's a debate that's important to have, and there are some very important lessons from the Japanese experience that Chinese officials and policymakers need to take very seriously.
So does Xi Jinping have enough tools in his toolkit to do those suggestions that you made for China?
He's got the tools. The question is, does he have the wherewithal and the willingness to use those tools? I mean, take productivity. The way I broke productivity down to you earlier was twofold. One, the shift in economic power from the private sector to state-owned enterprises. This is something that is very important to Xi Jinping. And affirming, as he the Chinese version of his remarks call it, the unswerving support to state-owned enterprises is a key pillar of his approach to governance. At the same time, productivity is being restrained in China now by the ongoing pressures that are now have been evident for nearly 4 years on the private sector. Initially, the internet platform companies, but that's spread, and How does China feel? How does Xi Jinping feel about giving more power to free-spirited, risk-taking, increasingly wealthy entrepreneurs? This is not something that Xi Jinping appears to be in support of right now. So, yeah, he's got the tools. He could make a lot of powerful changes and take tough decisions if he wants to, but his philosophy, his ideology right now is moving him away from making the types of choices that many of us, myself included, would like to see.
So, yeah, he does have the tools, but the question is, is he willing to use them? This year, the CDF is the first year the premier skipped the global CEO meeting, so you didn't get a chance to interact with Li Qiang. What do you think about Li Qiang and also his proposal to revive China's economy with the new trail, the EVs, solar panels, and lithium batteries?
I was at the CDF, and the premier chose to forego the normal meeting at the end, but he did address the CDF at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's arguable as to whether or not he has really altered his role in providing support to this once very powerful gathering. The focus that China has on shifting back to advanced manufacturing, underscored by areas that the U.S. is uncomfortable with, like EVs and batteries and solar, has become a very contentious issue. My own view is that in a world afflicted with horrific climate change, and we see this every day, I mean, as we're sitting here today, there are horrible fires that are destructively savaging Southern California and Northern California, and up and down the West Coast. We have you know, severe storms, a longer hurricane season, floods in the southern United States, and comparable developments in China and elsewhere around the world. There can be no surplus capacity of green technology. If China can produce green technology at scale, then let them do it. And we, if we can't do it, then shame on us. And China may be using subsidies to produce green technology, but you know, we have the opportunity, if we wish to do what China has done on green technology, to direct our own government support to that. We have passed through the Inflation Reduction Act a lot of subsidized support for green technology in the U.S. Who's to say that China's subsidies are unfair and ours are not?
Professor Roach, when I prepared for this interview, I did some research on the former Chinese premier's keynote speech in that CDF. And I found that contrary to Li Qiang, the current premier, the former premier, their speeches are more open and candid. Sometimes, like, even hard to imagine, you know, in today's political climate. Like, Wen Jiabao said, without the political reform, the economic reform cannot achieve the complete success. Things like that. Can you give us, because you have been there 24 years, right, some more details about interaction with those premiers, and then what they told you are the most impressive, and you still remember it today? Either from Wen Jiabao or from Zhu Rongji, because I saw a picture of you and Wen Jiabao on the bookshelf.
I've enjoyed being a participant in the China Development Forum. I did not go to the first one in 2000, but I went to every single one after that. And I had very prominent speaking roles, keynote speakers, panelists, and great opportunity to engage senior Chinese officials, including Zhu Rongji and Wen Jiabao, and the premiers that followed, along with other ministers of state. This past year when I went, I was disappointed that for the first time in 24 years, I was not allowed to speak. And I was told very clearly that because I have become more cautious on the Chinese economy and my views on Hong Kong are somewhat controversial right now, that they would rather not have me speak. And I was disappointed in that because I viewed that as an opportunity to really do what we did at the beginning with the Zhu Rongji, engage and debate and probe the leadership on Chinese and global issues that needed to be addressed. And to have my views silenced was disappointing, but I still went. I wrote an article after on my plane ride back. I think the title of it was What's the Point? In other words, why did I go? And I went because I thought it was important to see how China has changed, to see that for myself. And I concluded that, you know, I feel it's important to keep showing up and keep trying to engage the Chinese in issues of mutual interest and that are constructively put in China's best interest, which is what I have always done.
How has things changed?
The climate in China has changed. It has become more driven and dominated by Xi Jinping than was certainly evident in the early years of the CDF. The CDF was a brilliant concept created by, for my money, you know, China's most strategic modern premier, Zhu Rongji. He felt that at the conclusion of the National People's Congress, that the ministers of state needed to go in front of foreign experts, and I was fortunate enough to be included in that group, who would challenge and debate them about the policies that were just enacted by the National People's Congress. That the premier should be accountable for the message delivered in the work report of the government that had occurred, you know, a few weeks earlier than the CDF. And the CDF served as a platform for engagement and debate between China and the outside world. Over the years, the CDF became big and the government philosophy in support of engagement changed. And now, you know, under Xi Jinping, there's a desire that he has expressed personally to just tell the good stories of China. In other words, agree with me or don't talk. And that's what ended up, I think, stifling my views at this year's CDF. Because while I personally feel I am trying to tell the good stories of China, but this is what you got to do to make it good again, that it's not good right now, they didn't want to hear that. I did have the opportunity in a closed-door session the day after the CDF was concluded. It was attended by all the CDF officials. I think it's called the Boji Macro Forum. I was invited to express, and I let them know how I felt about their approach and how I felt that they were missing an opportunity. And I'm not sure they liked that, but I did get to express my point of view. And the idea of stifling contrary points of view doesn't work. It doesn't work in this country, and it won't work in China. And it certainly is not working well in Hong Kong right now as well. And it's unfortunate, but that's an outgrowth of the sort of the political climate that we're in right now, and if we let sort of a narrow approach to domestic politics driven by ideology, power, and control drive the engagement with academics and other well-meaning observers around the world, then we're not going to benefit. And it's important to be able to speak truth to power in any system, in any nation around the world, including, I might add, the United States.
You have a lot of friends. I don't know if they are your friends anymore in Hong Kong as well as in Beijing. How do you feel that you found out they wouldn't listen to your advice anymore?
I do. Over the years, I've made many, many good friends in China, and they're still good friends of mine. I've made many friends in Hong Kong, where I lived for a number of years, and they're still good friends of mine. Is our relationship a little bit more uncomfortable today than it used to be? Probably, because I'm not as optimistic on the future of China, the future of Hong Kong, as I used to be during the early years of our friendship. But they know me well enough. They know my intentions are good. They still call me a friend of China. That my comments are not just a broken record, always saying the same thing all the time. When it was John Maynard Keynes who said, when the facts change, I change my mind. I've been pretty transparent and pretty honest in stating the reasons for my change of view on both China and Hong Kong. And I think my good friends still respect me for that. When I was last in Hong Kong in July, I met with many, many of my good friends. They held meetings and dinners for me. I was given the opportunity to address the Foreign Correspondents Club in China. There was tremendous interest in hearing my honest assessment of the prospects. And as somebody who has been very, very positive on China for most of my career, but someone who has now turned less optimistic, there's a credibility with my shift of view that is important for my friends and others to hear. And I still sense a real willingness to understand and appreciate that.
The Financial Times article, that the title is, it pains you to say Hong Kong is over despite disagreement from many in Hong Kong and Beijing. But given Hong Kong's linkage, in your article you said linkage with China's economy, do you think it also signals a more pessimistic outlook for China's economy?
No, I would put it the other way. I mean, I first of all, you know, the title Hong Kong is over was meant to spark debate as opposed to be, you know, an epitaph that goes on Hong Kong's tombstone. And it sparked a tremendous amount of debate in Hong Kong. And I cited three reasons for that. One, the slowdown in the Chinese economy, the relationship between the Chinese ups and downs of Chinese economic growth and Hong Kong are very, very close. And with China experiencing growth problems for reasons we've already discussed, that seemed to be pretty much a reasonable way to look at the prospects for Hong Kong. I also argued that Hong Kong was caught in the crossfire between the U.S.-China conflict, and with that ongoing, that would prove problematic for Hong Kong. And the third point I made was the one that really made a number of my friends very uneasy, and they pushed back on me on that, and that was the shifting political winds in Hong Kong through the initially Beijing's national security law that was enacted for Hong Kong, then followed by the Article 23 legislation of LegCo more recently. And, you know, there's been a real chill, I think, in what had been a free and open political climate in Hong Kong since the big demonstrations of 2019, and that has continued to this very day. So when I put all this together, I guess if I had to rewrite the title of the article, it would be sort of "The Hong Kong That You Once Knew Is Over." There is a new Hong Kong. It's very different than the one that we had all become accustomed to. And for those of us who work there, like myself, had thrived in for a number of years. It's a very, very different place.
Can you please talk more about your experience in Hong Kong? You have lived there for like 6 years. How do you feel about acknowledging Hong Kong's demise and see a totally different Hong Kong right now?
I do love Hong Kong. I traveled there extensively, and then in 2007, Morgan Stanley asked me to go to Hong Kong and become the chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia. And I initially turned my CEO, John Mack, down because I had what I thought was the best job on imaginable. I was an economist, and I was the chief economist at Morgan Stanley, and that's all I ever wanted to do. And he was a very persuasive man, and I changed my mind. And I went there, and I loved it. I traveled all over the region. I lived in Hong Kong, but I spent half my time in the mainland. But I also traveled extensively to Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore, and deepened my already extensive relationship network. And I had the opportunity to comment on all aspects of the Asian and global economy, sort of to the dismay of Morgan Stanley management. They didn't like a senior executive making a provocative or offering provocative opinions. But I did it anyway because that's in my blood. That's what I wanted to do. And all these years later, I still do it. As I lived there for all those years and developed and deepened these relationships, my friends appreciated me for being honest and straightforward and calling it as I saw it. And so when circumstances changed, I had to modify my views to reflect those shifting circumstances. And most, but not all, of my friends understood that as somewhat, you know, a view, a shift in opinion coming from a good place, from a place they trusted, from an economist who had become a senior executive who then went on to teach at Yale, somebody who has the credibility and the passion and the interest to present a provocative and interesting view of a dynamic and rapidly changing region. And that's what I've tried to do.
You just said that Hong Kong has been trapped in this crossfire of U.S.-China rivalry. I can give two recent examples. One, State Department updated its business advisory on Hong Kong, and immediately Beijing said U.S. is using Hong Kong to contain China and smearing the business environment in Hong Kong. And then Congress passed a bill which could close the Hong Kong's trade offices across the state. And then John Lee, the Hong Kong chief executive, called it shameless and ugly. Trapped in the crossfire.
Yeah, those are examples. There's countless others. Many, not all, senior executives in Hong Kong have been personally sanctioned by the U.S. government. And there are freedom of press issues that are very serious, very evident in Hong Kong right now that have caused a lot of consternation in the West and the United States. The conflict is a very worrisome development. I've written a book about it recently called Accidental Conflict. I fear that this conflict is getting to a point from which there may be no easy exit unless we take some far more thoughtful and courageous actions to address it. I propose many of them in the book, and maybe we'll get to that in a few minutes. But to the extent that this conflict remains ongoing and the charges and countercharges continue to fly back and forth between Washington and Beijing and Hong Kong, that notion of Hong Kong being trapped in the crossfire, I'm afraid, is all too accurate.
Let's move on to the U.S.-China relations, which is your focus in your book and the recent article. But let me begin with my personal memory about China Week. When we talk about China Week, like two decades or one decade ago, it's a week long in Washington, D.C., celebrating Chinese culture, like a Chinese opera in Kennedy Center, things like that. But now in Washington, D.C., the China Week means a week long nonstop passing bills from the House. There are 25 of them. I cannot list all of them, but I can read three of them to you. It's like CCP Drone Act, Decoupling CCP Battery Act, and CCP's Dominance of EVs Act. What's your take on that? China Week, totally different meaning right now.
I worry a lot about the the extreme outbreak of negative sentiment toward China in the United States. Now, nearly a couple of years ago, the U.S. House of Representatives set up a new House Select Committee on China, alleging that they were focusing on the anti-competitive practices of the Communist Party of China. But it was a hearing and a committee initially chaired by a strident anti-China congressman from Wisconsin by the name of Mike Gallagher, who has since retired from the Congress, that viewed China on a par with the worst of our post-World War II adversaries, the former Soviet Union. And they held very contentious hearings that were reminiscent of the Red Scare of the early 1950s that drew our attention to a senator from Wisconsin this time, who was ultimately censured by the Senate, Senator Joe McCarthy. These were very contentious, inflammatory hearings, and they were followed by a number of allegations made about Chinese adversarial practices ranging from Huawei and TikTok to electric vehicles, Chinese construction cranes, and a number of other allegations. So I wrote an article a couple of years ago called "America: The Risks of American Sinophobia," that we have gone too far in condemning all aspects of China, and if we're not careful, we're turning what had been a narrowly focused trade war into a broad-based systemic clash between two civilizations that would ultimately end up having adverse consequences for the people-to-people relationships, which is the core of the, I think, the common and aspirations that the citizens of our two countries have. If you look at now at public opinion polls that reflect American sentiment toward China conducted by the Pew Research Organization in Washington, you will find the American public has the most negative opinion of China since the survey was conducted now nearly 20 years ago. And I find that very, very worrisome. And everywhere our senior officials turn, there's another China threat around the corner. Right now, we're in the midst of contentious hearings over TikTok. And that's just one of, as you pointed out, countless examples of this China fear syndrome that I think has gone well beyond where it needs to be.
The 25 bills recently passed in the House include military, economic, and also technology, because the tech war between the United States and China. In your book, you have a whole chapter on Huawei viewing us a Trojan horse and also the biggest enemy in this tech war between the United States and China. Could you please use Huawei as an example to help us examine, does United States have a winning strategy in this tech war with China?
Well, let me just back up a tiny bit. My latest book, Accidental Conflict, you have it right here. Maybe we should hold it up to see an example of this brilliant piece of literature. The subtitle of it is America, China, and the Clash of False Narratives. And the thesis of this book is that both nations, the United States and China, have embraced false narratives about the other, that it is politically expedient for this to have occurred, and that if we don't watch out, the clash of these false narratives on both sides of the relationship could set us up for a hot war that goes beyond the Cold War fears that we've been seeing in recent years. Huawei is a lightning rod in this false narrative debate. Huawei certainly is a very important technology company in China. Some might argue the most important technology company in China. And we are convinced that Huawei is a threat to us initially because they would they were the most powerful producer of 5G telecommunications equipment. And we were convinced that they were going to build a back door into their 5G servers and routers and other aspects of their telecommunication platform, that at the whim of a misdirected leader in Beijing, they would open the back door and take over the American telecommunication system and bring our nation to a halt. There was no evidence that they were going to do that. They've been developing telecommunications equipment for 35 years. There's no evidence they've done that in the past at scale. There have been a few times where there have been glitches reported in Australia and Italy, I believe, but they've been addressed very quickly. But we've taken actions by sanctioning Huawei through the U.S. entity list and Huawei's supply chain network that were very much aimed at shutting down Huawei. And what I warned in the book is we have to be careful what we wish for, because Huawei is driven by a very competitive culture, very competitive founder of Huawei. The tighter we close the noose on Huawei, the greater the incentive Huawei will be to develop its own homegrown or indigenous products that will they'll be able to produce without the inputs and components that come from the United States and its allies. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened. Mm-hmm. So Huawei, they basically saw their mobile phone business under tremendous pressure in 2020, in 2021. The revenues collapsed. Huawei's market share collapsed, but they didn't give up. They worked very hard in developing their own chip-producing and assembly capacity at home, and they've come up with some
new
models.
Yeah, they just released their new
mobile
phones.
Yeah, there's the
recently
one. There's a new one that came out sort of on Apple Day. That is a
on the same day.
It's got two folds in it, so it's a
three folds.
It's got three pieces, but two folds.
Right, that's true.
And the market share of that product certainly is far outstripped what had been the leading market share of Apple. And Huawei products are selling well around the world, everywhere, of course, except the United States and in markets of our allies that we're able to get some cooperation on in terms of our sanctions. But is Huawei a stronger company as a result of what we've done to try to squeeze them? Some might argue yes. That's the unintended consequences of trying to single out one strong company that invests heavily in research and development has a surprisingly aggressive and effective strategy for survival.
Professor Roach, we know that election year in the United States always make U.S.-China relations even more complicated. In the presidential TV debate, President Trump said that he's tough on China, and Harris accusing him of selling chips to China and said that we have to win this AI race, both basically trying to show that I am tougher on China. What do we learn from Harris and Trump's China policy? Do you see a trade war 2.0 after the election, and the tech war will evolve into a forever war after the election? What's your projection on that?
You're entirely right. I mean, in a presidential election, given the politicized negative sentiment that exists in the United States on a bipartisan basis against China, that no one candidate is going to come out and say, I want to do it differently, that I'm going to be more conciliatory toward China. Kamala Harris does not have a new set of policies that's different from her current boss, Joe Biden, who's been, if anything, more negative on China than his predecessor. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris's competitor right now, Donald Trump, was. So the trade war has morphed into a tech war. It's morphed into a Cold War. And the risks of it going further are very real. I hope that doesn't happen. I take heart from recent diplomatic initiatives by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan recent rounds of other diplomatic initiatives on climate, energy, financial services, and generalized commerce-to-commerce department activities. I don't view those as breakthroughs. I view those actions as stabilizing for a few more months a troubled relationship. The last thing that either candidate wants is to see China the U.S.-China conflict escalate dramatically, leading into the weeks before a very contentious presidential election. So, you know, I think the big issue will come after the election, and whether or not, depending on who wins, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump has a different vision than appears to be the case right now. I wouldn't count on President Trump being the one to resolve the conflict, but I hold out the possibility that Kamala Harris might listen to her vice president, new vice president Tim Walz, who has a lot of experience in as an educator in leading groups to China and has a more nuanced view of China than most of the hawks his colleagues in Washington have right now.
In your recent article, actually, you said if Harris prevails in November, Tim Walz may play an important role, like fostering the Nixon-style breakthrough in U.S.-China relations. But Professor Roach, many people in Washington right now, they view Kissinger, Nixon, and engagement mistake. I think those are mistakes who lead to the problems right now.
Yeah.
Do we really need another Nixon or another engagement now?
Engagement, you're entirely right, has become a four-letter word in Washington. The view in Washington is we did that and look at the trouble we're in right now. And so nobody wants to do engagement. And what I wrote recently was, could Kamala Harris be the next Richard Nixon? Could she shift the needle back toward a more constructive re-engagement with China? Let's remember that when Richard Nixon went to China over 50 years ago, he was one of America's leading anti-communist politicians. But he appreciated the strategic opportunity that building a relationship with China might provide the United States. And Henry Kissinger shared that appreciation. And that re-engagement that began with his shocking trip to China that we watched on live television in the United States with absolute amazement at the time, some over 50 years ago, that did over time lead to a thawing of then a serious conflict, played a key role in bringing the Cold War to an end because it allowed China and the United States to put joint pressure on the former Soviet Union. But then things, you know, eventually went from being ice cold to warm and filled with constructive engagement. Now the pendulum swung back the other way. We blame China for a lot of the problems that we're having at home, and China does the same with us. My clash of false narratives again. And so we need a better way for the nations to think about engagement. And I've written about that. I've called it a new architecture of engagement. And I do not think that engagement needs to be seen as a threat or a new four-letter word that will forever poison the U.S.-China relationship.
Professor Roach, you just mentioned that before the election, we have seen diplomatic exchanges between Washington and Beijing recently, including Sullivan's visit, DOD's dialogue, also Department of Treasury, and others, and even potential phone call or meeting, we don't know, between Biden and Xi Jinping. But in your article, you said those may not be enough to stabilize the relations. Your proposal is a U.S.-China Secretariat. Tell us more about your proposal and how would it help to do the conflict resolution.
I think diplomacy is necessary, but not sufficient for conflict resolution. You think about diplomacy, it's conducted by individuals. It's a very personalized approach to dealing with bilateral problems. And so it is sensitive to the mood, the ego of individuals, their political standing, what they can gain or lose for engaging with another nation. And so, I applaud the efforts that we've seen in recent months, but we need more than that because, as I said earlier, after the election, what are we left with? So I am in favor of shifting our focus of re-engagement from the pure personalization of diplomacy to an institutionalization focused on establishing a new U.S.-China secretariat. And briefly, a secretariat to me is a permanent organization that operates 24/7 and focuses on a broad range of issues affecting the United States and China, from trade and economics to technology and innovation to subsidies for government and state-owned enterprises to the big sort of existential issues like climate, global health, internet security, even human rights. And the Secretariat is empowered to work collaborative with large complements of U.S. and Chinese professionals, call them technocrats if you want, producing white papers that end up endorsing policy solutions to tough problems. And I stress that this is an ongoing permanent organization that is very different than the episodic accomplishments that we can expect from the personalization of diplomacy. You need both. Personalization and institutionalization, diplomacy and a secretariat. And I think that's what could give us the type of insight, opportunity, and a potential Nixon-like breakthrough in setting up a climate of re-engagement with China. We need to be engaged with the second most powerful nation in the world. We're so focused on conflict right now that we raise the risk that the current Cold War could turn into something worse. And if I write another book, and I'm thinking about it right now, it will be about the imperatives of re-engagement with China.
In today's political climate, would that be difficult?
It would be impossible in the current political climate. But after the election, when the dust settles,
do you think it'll change?
There is an opportunity for a strategic rethinking of our relationship with China. The current approach has failed. It's not working. And, you know, we can send all the Jake Sullivans in the world to Beijing and the Wang Yis to Washington, D.C., but they are not the answer. And we need diplomacy, but we need a platform along the lines of what I've described as a secretariat to really work on a full-time basis with broad complements of resources to address the multiplicity of problems that our nations face. And we have so much to be gained by collectively resolving difficult problems. Like, just look at COVID. I mean, COVID was once in a century pandemic that caused countless deaths and illnesses around the world. And if a secretariat had existed at the time, mm-hmm. the secretary could have immediately convened an international, to say nothing of a bilateral conference that involved scientists, epidemiologists, public health authorities, to get to the bottom of this and to prescribe the protocols for developing vaccines that would have been disseminated around the world. Instead, what did we do? We politicized it. We wanted to blame the Chinese for creating COVID. They then created some narratives that blamed us for creating COVID, and it's become a contentious source of political debate under the purview of a secretariat. We could have made far more progress in dealing with this disease before it caused some 4 to 5 million unnecessary deaths. And it's still ongoing today.
So maybe after the election, when the political rhetorics, ease and the environment will change. So what advice would you offer to the next U.S. president, as well as Xi Jinping, how to manage these complexities of U.S.-China relations, especially in the event of China's economic problem?
First of all, far be it from me to have, to be able to come up with a perfect recipe for a U.S. president or a foreign leader. Mm-hmm. But my experience in addressing global problems is they're usually, and this goes back decades in looking at various crises from the dot-com to the global financial crisis.
2008 financial crisis.
All of these various crises. They're best addressed mm-hmm. by dealing with problems in your own country first. When you have successfully repaired the problems in your nation, you're operating from a position of strength to deal with your adversaries around the world. And I think we need to do that in the United States, and I think China needs to do that as well.
So back to we talk about you have been advocated the consumption-led rebalancing of China's economy for many years in CDF, the China Development Forum.
I've been, focused on consumer-led rebalancing. Mm-hmm. My first articles were written about this in 2006, 2007, following statements by former Premier Wen Jiabao in March of 2007, when he warned of the Chinese economy, while it was strong on the surface, beneath the surface was unstable, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and ultimately unsustainable. And to me, that triggered a big debate inside of China about the need to shift the dynamic of the economy away from exports and investment mm-hmm. Toward internal private consumption. And what I focused on was the excessively high savings rate in China, which has gotten even higher since then, because of the combination of the demographic aging that we addressed earlier and the lack of a well-funded, high benefit-paying social safety net with respect to both retirement and health care. And China has not followed through in taking the actions, I think, that address the excesses of fear-driven precautionary saving arising out of that combination of aging and a weak social safety net. Again, the actions are easy to understand and are well within the grasp of Xi Jinping and his senior policymakers to take, but for reasons that are not altogether clear. Those actions have not been taken.
So, Professor Roach, you predicted accurately the financial crisis in 97 and 2008, right? So I assume that you have a perfect sense, like, when the storm is coming. So I know you're not a Chinese economic crisis camp, but do you see any signs that similar to the same level financial crisis coming to China? Because if it's coming, if there's a sign there, you will sense it, right?
Well, first of all, I do not have the perfect sense of the future that you graciously described in posing your question. I have never been in the crisis camp for China. But my views in the last few years have become far more cautious for many of the reasons that we discussed earlier. The cyclical pressures, especially the property crisis, and the structural pressures, especially demography and productivity and weak consumption, have also pointed to. And so I've lowered my sights on China's long-term growth potential, but I do not see a China collapse or an implosion of Chinese economic growth many in the West argue is likely, and as some in the West have argued, would be evident all the time over the last 25 years. I remember my sort of friend, Gordon Chang, who wrote a book, The Coming Collapse of China. I think that book was written 20 years ago, and he keeps writing new editions, you know. And I've told him, you know, just keep writing it. Maybe one of these days you might be, you know, half right. He hasn't appreciated that. But, I think that China is a large, strategically focused, developing economy, still has many sources of economic growth to tap. I do believe that China has gone off the course of solid growth it has been on and needs many adjustments to deal with property, to deal with aging, to deal with productivity issues that China needed to face up to consumer-led rebalancing. If China begins to, I think, move more strategically in tapping those sources of growth and then address this seemingly existential conflict with the United States, I think China's got ample opportunity for sustainable growth for many, many years, if not decades to come.
Thank you so much, Professor Roach, for sharing with us your valuable insights as well as personal story with us today. We truly appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you.